Let's go.
This is an oral history recording at Westminster School on the 5th of June 2019 with Elizabeth Wells, archivist, and
Rodney Harris, deputy head academic.
I'd like to begin by talking a little bit about your background. I wondered if you could tell me a bit about your family and where you grew up.
I grew up not a zillion miles away from here in South East London in Bromley, and then trotted off to school at St Dunstan's College on the South Circular, alma mater of the Dean.
What did your parents do?
My father was an accountant and then company secretary, and my mother was a housewife.
And did you have any brothers and sisters?
I had one sister who is 11 years older than me.
Okay, so a bit of a gap.
Bit of a gap, yes. Yeah. I think I was the afterthought, or the one they thought never was going to happen.
And did you enjoy your time at school? Did you enjoy St Dunstan's?
I really did enjoy it. It was two train rides from home, but I loved every single minute of my time there. I liked it because it was relatively small. There are other schools I could have gone to in that part of the world, but it was sort of friendly and you actually got to know everybody in your year group. And that was important.
And did any of your teachers there make a big impression on you?
I suppose two teachers in particular. One, not surprisingly, was my geography teacher for the last 2 years, who was a bundle of energy and passion and enthusiasm. That rubbed off onto me. And also my chemistry teacher, which is in a way why I ended up doing geography, maths and chemistry for A-level. And those two subjects, chemistry and maths, I really, really enjoyed. And that, I think, took me down the road into physical geography at university more than human.
And you went to Cambridge to read geography.
Yeah.
How do you remember the application process?
How do I remember the application process? What I do remember about it was because, actually, we went away on holiday. We had a family holiday. And the A-level results came out whilst we were away, and I didn't want to bother myself whilst I was on holiday, so we came home to open the results, and it was at that point, because I'd already decided I was going to have a year out and apply seventh term, and so we went off on holiday, came back home, found that the grades were good enough to apply to Cambridge, and so that weekend we then went up to Cambridge and looked around the colleges, and I decided that Downing was probably as nice a place as any, because it didn't have small courtyards, even though it was impoverished and only built on three sides. So that was how that decision went. And then I just had a fabulous seventh term at school.
Would you explain a bit about the seventh term? Because I imagine some people listening might not really know very much about that that process.
So in those days, seventh term was pretty much the norm that you would apply to Oxford and Cambridge after your A-levels in most instances, with your results known. But then you had to do a huge amount of preparation for the exams which came just before Christmas. And so that really was the seventh term when I've never worked so hard, and suddenly the subject went to a much higher level. But that was very much the norm in those days. You thought the seventh term rather than get it all done in the 2 years and leave school.
And when did you begin in Cambridge? Did you start in the January?
No, I started in October of 77. So that means I had two terms off when I went to work at a small prep school in Beckenham.
Ah, so your first experience of teaching.
My first experience of teaching, so I did games every afternoon and I helped out in the classroom, yes.
And did you enjoy it immediately? Did you start to think this is what you wanted to do?
I didn't really think that at the time. I thought this was quite good fun, but it was also a curious existence because the person who owned the prep school, he was an academic of sorts. And so he ran the prep school, but also he sort of dabbled in all sorts of historical research. And so I used to go with him on a Wednesday afternoon to the Institute of Historical Research in London to be his research assistant, which usually consisted of doing lots of photocopying. And then he started to get me into doing some data processing for him on climate change. And so that sort of meshed very nicely with the geography. And I actually sort of went back, I basically had a job there every holiday from university, guaranteed, to sort of help out a bit in the school, but also to continue being his research assistant.
And did you enjoy your time at Cambridge?
Cambridge, I loved. Cambridge was just wonderful. So much to do in college, so much to do out of college. The 3 years just whistled by, and that was why I ended up staying there for the fourth and even better year of learning how to teach.
And after your teacher training, where was your first posting?
My first posting was at Marlborough College. So that was it. So I did my year of teacher training. They sent me off to, in my first term of teacher training, they sent me off to the Manor in Cambridge, which is the toughest comprehensive in Cambridge, on the basis that I was never going to teach in a school like that, so they thought I'd better experience it. and that was quite an eye-opener. And then I had a term of teaching at Haberdashers at Elstree, which was good, different. And Marlborough was the first job I applied for. And I thought, well, it's actually quite good coming out of university if someone's going to put a roof over your head and feed you, as well as pay you.
Was that your first proper experience of a boarding school then?
That was my first experience of the immersive boarding environment, 24/7.
And was it a bit of a shock to the system, or...?
I think I was ready to do something different, having done my 4 years at Cambridge. Because I declined the opportunity to stay on and do some research. And because you just get swept along with the whole pace of life there, it's not as fast-paced as Westminster, but it is the fact that there's always something going on. So if you're not teaching, you're doing games, and if you're not doing games, you're helping at the boarding house, and it runs through Saturdays and Sundays. So in a sort of curious way, I never had the time really to think about that.
And Marlborough had girls at that point?
Marlborough did have sixth form girls at that point, yes. Okay. Which was interesting. And Marlborough was sort of quite turbulent at that period. And so one was having to get used to all sorts of different things. Lively boys, some not very able. A common room which wasn't terribly happy and content. So I think it's learning the job the hard way.
And you were there for quite a while before coming on to Westminster.
I was there for 9 years, but it was in my eighth year there that I was appointed here, and so I took the job 18 months before coming.
And what prompted the move?
I'd sort of, when I'd been at Marlborough for 9 years, or however long, the head of department had been there for an eternity, and there was still an eternity to go. Suffice it to say, he clocked up over 100 terms as head of department, which takes some doing. And I could have stayed at Marlborough forever and a day, and it had been so nice to have a boarding house, to run a boarding house, because they're like palaces and you sort of live like a lord. But then Jim Cogan, who was the Master of the Queen's Scholars and Undermaster here in his time, he knew one of the geography staff at Marlborough, and it was at the time that Westminster were thinking they wanted to do something to the geography department. And so Jim came down and had a chat with me and said, would you like to come to Westminster? So I sort of thought about it and ummed and ahed, and David Summerscale ummed and ahed about whether we were going to find a time to interview. And then he said to me, well, can you go and have a look at what's wrong with the geography department? And so I went off and I told him what I thought was wrong with the geography department. And then he offered me the job and I said, I'll come, but I will come a year on so that I can actually do some work on it from afar, because otherwise if I come as it is now, I think I might lose the will to live.
So you were effectively headhunted by Jim Cogan.
By Jim Cogan, if you can believe that.
And what was your impression of David Summerscale when you came and had these interviews with him?
He was a man looking for an answer. He knew that geography at Westminster wasn't quite right, but he couldn't work out in his own mind what was wrong with it, or if he could, he wasn't going to tell me. I think he didn't honestly know. Mm. And it was when I basically said to him that the two people, Stuart Murray and Mike Williams, Stuart Murray had been here forever and a day, and had taught absolutely everything from PE to Spanish to geography to economics. And Stuart had in fact taught Mike when Mike was at Westminster. And so it really was the problem compounded because Stuart had taught Mike. What was really telling was that neither could teach the entire GCSE course on their own, so they had to split it into the bits they were comfortable with. And it was at that point when I was sort of explaining to David why it just wasn't working and why nobody was doing it and why the results really were utterly shameful for Westminster that we sort of began to formulate a plan.
Mm. And was it nice for you to return to London, to come home?
I didn't really think it was coming home, actually. I'd sort of been away for so long, sort of whatever it was, 4 years in Cambridge, and I came back in for the holidays, and 9 years in Marlborough. Because in the first year, we lived down at Maida Vale in a school flat in Lauderdale Mansions, so it was about as far removed from any experience of London I'd ever had before. It was nice in the sense that then one got to know London from inside, and actually being part of it from the very, very centre, and then moving into Barton Street, one gets a totally different view. So suburbs and centre, I don't think there's too much in common.
Mm. So you were brought in as the reforming head of geography. What was the status like as a head of department back in the 1990s, early 1990s?
If I said that one was the lowest of the low, it might be sort of close to the truth. There were housemasters who wouldn't speak to me because I was a geographer and because I had been brought in to sort out the geography department. One was battling with colleagues who actively told their pupils that they shouldn't be doing geography at all because it was a complete waste of time. And so sort of one felt one was going against the grain. Not a single scholar did geography beyond the fifth form. They were all told they mustn't do it. One was sort of having to live with that. And it's sort of, at times I thought, oh dear, why on earth have I come here? And we'll just sort of have to grin and bear it and see if we can find a way out of it. And then it just sort of gradually turned. In fact, it was once we got one or two scholars doing it, then the subject suddenly got a little bit more respectability within the school.
Were there regular heads of department meetings back in those days? Or?
There were heads of department meetings, regular heads of department meetings. Then we also had the challenge committee as well. So those were running side by side. And some of those heads of department meetings were pretty waspish affairs because there were some pretty strong characters there. Michael has been the ever-present there. Michael has done as many heads of department meetings as me over the last 29 years. Goes back even longer. People like Andrew Hobson were there as well, and it was quite a bear garden.
Hmm. Was there a sense that everybody was trying to defend their own little empire, their little fight?
I think there was not only defending one's own corner, there was also a fair amount of clever sniping comments. As you can imagine from a Westminster common room, particularly with everybody sort of thinking it was open season because the meetings weren't chaired terribly well.
And where did those meetings happen?
We used to have the meetings in the Busby Library. In that great room, these heads of department and challenge committee meetings took place. Then the numbers were much smaller of heads of department. Numbers have grown like topsy over the years. But nevertheless, it was just, it sort of set itself up for combat in a way, with a sort of semicircular shape to the room and David sitting in the middle of it all and letting all pass before him.
Did people have regular seats? Were there?
No, it wasn't quite as bad as that. When Debbie taught at City of London Girls in that first year I was here, she used to complain that staff meetings, the women all had their regular seats, and she went in there and was told off for sitting there, that so-and-so seat. And she said, "You're so lucky at Westminster, you don't have to put up with that."
And did you meet Debbie at Marlborough?
I met Debbie at Marlborough when I was already leaving, because I was acting head of geography in my last year there. And Debbie arrived in that September to help launch full co-education. And so we met at the drinks party in the master's drawing room for new staff and their heads of department. And because I had a new geographer and Debbie was a new mathematician, that was where we met.
So she came to London with you?
So she came to London with me. I already had a job here. And so she took the first job that was respectable, which was at City of London Girls. And then after a year, she arrived at Westminster.
And what was that like, having a spouse in the common room?
What was it like? It was bearable, interesting. At least we ended up with the same holidays, which was fantastic. Half terms never matched when Debbie was at City. But because one's busy here, you don't actually see much of each other at all.
So no sense of having an ally against the sniping? Or
No sense at all. Debbie would snipe as well as anybody else.
So the next big thing that happens is Purcells comes along.
So that was the next thing, yes. Which wasn't Purcells to start with. David Summerscale said, "I want you to turn Barton Street houses into a proper house." And I said, "What's the name of the house?" Well, he said, "You can call it Barton Street." And then Eddie Smith, as archivist, suddenly realised what was going on. Said, "You can't call it Barton Street." And so that's when we ended up having to go through the process of finding a name for it. So that was 1994, but I was not allowed to give up being head of geography at that point.
No, and that would seem so alien now, I think, to anyone in the common room, the idea that you would be a housemaster and a head of department.
Yes.
Did it feel quite difficult? Did it feel like a lot of work?
It did feel like a lot of work, and I just sort of had to realise there were times when I just had to create space to deal with the geography, and at times I had to create space for the house rather than trying to do the two together. But I sort of managed to work that one out.
And Purcells, as we know it now, was at that stage purely girls, because it was purely a sixth form.
Only sixth form girls.
But it had day girls as well as
boarders? We had no day girls at all. And so it was girls in numbers 2 and 4. We lived in number 5. 4 and 5 were interconnected top and bottom, and there were 2 rooms in the attic space above us in number 5.
So surrounded.
Totally surrounded. And number 3 was owned by somebody who had real money and had nothing to do with Westminster School. Who was a member of the House of Lords.
Did they mind being surrounded by...
No, they didn't mind being surrounded. I think that the locals quite liked it because it brought some youth into the street, because most of the residents in Barton Street then were 70-plus.
And had you moved there from Maida Vale?
We did a year in Maida Vale, and then the school decided it was going to sell Lauderdale Mansions. So we then went into 14 Barton Street and had the middle flat there.
Okay.
And then we had this ridiculous move 3 years later across the road. So the removal van insisted upon parking outside 14 and then going 10 yards across the road.
And you were in Barton Street. You were in Purcells for a long time. Did you very much enjoy seeing the house develop over that period?
Being there for 15 years was rather good, because it actually meant we had a house in the middle of London, a house which wasn't directly on the school site, so one sort of had a sort of degree of normality, and you can actually sort of park your car around the corner and you could take the shopping outside your front door. It also gave us the space to have a family, which was terrific. Otherwise we probably would have moved away from Westminster. So to actually have Tom and George in there and growing up, that just was at the right time for us. And I sort of think that David Summerscale knew that we were going to do that when he offered us the house, because there was a twinkle in his eye.
Often when people are appointed to the position of housemaster, there's a sense that the head at the time is eyeing up their partner and wondering quite what they're going to bring to the mix. It's interesting in a world where we don't have spousal appointments anymore, but obviously there's going to be something contributed by your partner. Was Debbie happy with the move? Did she enjoy being part of Purcell's?
Debbie was happy with the move. Because at the same time Debbie had been made mistress in charge of girls, and so there was a sort of synergy between the two, and we just shared the job. We just saw it as a job which we did between us, and that sort of worked, and the girls liked it. So when Debbie was expecting each child, and the girls enjoyed that, they enjoyed seeing the boys grow up. And so, I mean, it was basically a family effort.
One of the things I really like about the photographs that we've got for Purcell's, the house photographs, is that we've got your sons in them, and you can see the boys getting older.
Acutely embarrassed every time we bring those out.
Did you have a matron as well?
We had a succession of matrons. Matron lived in number two. Mm-hmm. So we had Jane Fitzmaurice, whom we inherited. Then we had Carolyn Mortimer White, who was with us for quite some time. Carolyn was great. And then Georgina. Georgina White. So we were well served by matrons.
What do you think it was like being a girl at Westminster back then? How do you think it's different from the girls' experience today?
Westminster girls have always been lively. Westminster girls have always been prepared to throw themselves into what is going on. And that it was true then as much as it is now. I think that is very much the case. I think at the time we were there, it became slightly more international in flavour, the house. I think the girls have become more obsessed about academic performance and results. That's not to say they weren't when we took over in 1994 and started to create the house. But certainly over the years, there was increasing focus amongst them. You actually sense there was more greater desire to work harder and harder, and I think in part that comes from pressure from home, and certainly the parental conversations that I had changed over that 15-year period.
Do you think parents are now, certainly from what I hear, parents seem to be much more actively involved, and much more of the housemaster role is managing parents than was back in the day?
Yes, I think parents increasingly have take the view that we're paying all of this money and we want a say in what is going on, and we want to sort of micromanage a lot of the things which we don't like, and we will intervene directly rather than let our daughters take up the battle themselves. That's certainly the case whilst we were there. As I said at the outset, I had parents who were fussy and interfering, but towards the end, there was one morning when I had a mother who just walked straight in through the house into my office and just stood there and delivered her views on what had to be done. It's that sort of thing which became more complex. I think partly email has facilitated it. that you can fire off an email and you know that someone's going to receive it instantaneously rather than writing a letter and it sort of comes in the post, or picking up the phone, which isn't quite the same. But email, it's staring you in the face when you wake up in the morning or whatever.
What do you think some of the specific challenges to girls and in terms of pastoral care and discipline compared with boys?
Good question. Good question. Because when I was at Marlborough, I lived in a house with boys, and after about, well, turn it round. When we went into the house, Debbie was expecting Tom. And Tom was born in the November. We started off in now the 1st of September 1994. And I'd been saying all the way through, oh, I so hope we have a little girl. I so want a little girl. And 2 weeks in, I said to Debbie, we are not having girls. We are only having boys. And now, boys, you can blast them to kingdom come. You can tell them off. You can have a row with them. And 5 minutes later, they're all smiles and laughing, joking. And the girls, it is even the smallest thing. The individual's upset. She gets all her friends upset on her behalf. And 2, 3, 4, 5 days later, you're still paying the price for having dared to speak to her about something which hasn't gone right. So I think girls, certainly in that sense, present different challenges. I think by and large the girls are more compliant than the boys. That's certainly my experience of it. Or if the girls want to get up to, things which they shouldn't be getting up to are better at disguising the fact. Which was certainly the case with the ones we had in the house. So the neighbours were always good at telling me who was up late, because they'd be sort of across the road and you have a conversation with the next morning. What else about girls at Westminster in that sense? I think just basically I think girls as a whole, and it was true at Marlborough, they're just far more focused. And they are much more mature than the boys. They are focused when they come in the sixth form, in the way that the boys, perhaps in the upper shell, aren't. The girls just want to get on with it. I remember I've talked to admissions tutors over the years, and two or three of them have said to me, you know, we don't take too much notice of boys' GCSEs because we know that boys wake up to life a lot later than the girls, because the girls will have strings of top grades and the boys won't necessarily, but the boys know that they've got to deliver come A level, and there's a degree of that.
Were you must have had a big part to play in the selection process too when those girls were coming in at sixth form?
Yes, so what did I do? I did the general interviews at that time. And so that really was a question of fit, and what are they going to contribute to boarding? Are they the right sort of person to board? Which is easier said than done, because you know, you see the girls when they're aged 15 and a bit, and they're joining you 9 months later. And as I always said to parents, 6 months is a long time in the life of a teenager. 6 weeks is a long time in the life of a teenager, and seeing how some of them change between offering them a place and admission starting out here is quite extraordinary. But we did always try to make sure that yes, they could cope academically, that's important, but it's not necessarily the right place for the faint-hearted, particularly boarding.
When were you allowed to relinquish your head of department role?
In 2013.
Oh, wow.
Yes. So it took me right the way through the house. It took me right the way through starting off as director of studies up until 2013, and then Sarah took it on, and subsequently Julia.
Do you think you were a victim of your own success there?
I fear so, yes. Because Simon had got a house in 2009, and so that would be the logical movement for the job, and then I stayed with it, so I ended up doing far too many jobs, but in a way you sort of get into the routine a bit, and mostly when you've got a really good team working with you, it makes the whole thing so much easier.
Do you think geography still slightly suffers from the reputation you described when you first arrived? You know, that it's...
I think it suffers, particularly amongst... There's a parental perception. That's where a lot of it comes from, because parents sort of think in terms of science at Westminster, classics at Westminster, maths at Westminster. Geography is a bit newfangled. It was in their day, in sort of 1960s, early 70s, geography really wasn't great in schools. And so that comes through when you talk to parents. And if they want to do anything which is vaguely to do with geography, then economics sounds much more fun and much more related to the lives which many of them lead, parental occupations. So I think it suffers in that respect. And you know, geography does suffer in prep schools from being the poor relation, just as dear old Stuart Murray ended up teaching geography alongside PE. So you will find that prep school geography can often be taught in that way. And so that is an issue, particularly for very able children.
So whilst you were being housemaster of Purcell's, and whilst you were being head of geography, you experienced the change of headmasters, or two changes of headmasters. So first of all, Tristram, and then Stephen. And I wondered if you had any reflections on the different headmasters and
with David, it was always a decision is maybe. Tristram was just do it. And then Stephen went back into a totally different modus operandi. And you had to sort of look at everything afresh. And the tiniest detail you had to sort out as well. So you know, three very different styles of working. Which is good, because I think schools don't need the same again when the heads change, and if it actually makes the common think, if it makes you think professionally about what you're doing and how you're doing it and why you're doing it, then it has to be good. So, very, very different. At least with Stephen, you usually knew where you were. With Tristram, you didn't. And with David, it was just fine as long as you kept going and nothing too much ruffled anybody's feathers.
Do you think the role of the headmaster has changed in that time to the sort of activities that the headmaster gets up to?
Headmasters now are much more concerned with things like fundraising and the external periods of school. That's not to say they weren't in the past, because John Ray was certainly outwards facing. David Summerscale appeared and was really there to try and change all of that. Tristram was always going to be his own man. But I think headmasters are more concerned with making sure that there are enough people getting all the regulatory stuff right, getting all the things right for inspection, doing all of that. And I think there are many, many other distractions for heads these days, whether it's dealing with things like public benefit, dealing with things like overseas operations. Those are things which have appeared, but I still think it's very much how an individual head plays it, because some heads love talking to parents, some heads are happy to devolve. Patrick's happy to devolve and empower the management team. Stephen was totally the opposite.
And one of the big changes, I suppose, that happened under Stephen was the development more of a senior management team, just to spread that load, and I wondered if you might reflect a little bit on becoming Director of Studies.
That was an interesting experience, because I actually took over at an odd time of year, because we'd known for some while that Charles was going to give up, and then Charles decided he was going to bail out at half term in the Michaelmas term. I think largely because the governing body report for the academic side of life falls in the second half of the play term. So I ended up over half term having to put together the pieces which he'd started to assemble for it. So that's just suddenly a baptism of fire, because then you've suddenly got everybody coming at you, and so now you're doing your own thing as a house, and you're responsible for a limited number of pupils. You're doing your own thing as head of the department. I was sort of ready for it, prepared for it, because when I finished in the house, I then was running exams in universities, and so I was sort of operating across the school, and therefore it was quite an easy transition into sort of picking up some of the stuff as director of studies. Some of it was less easy to get my head around, back timetabling. It wasn't as bad as it could have been. As I say, sort of doing similar things for the previous year and a bit.
And having that overview obviously brought you into contact with probably colleagues that you didn't see that much of before. Was it difficult sort of chairing those heads of department meetings and learning more about what was going on in the different departments?
I made sure in the first year I really did get to know what was going on with the departments. The thing which helped me most of all was because I'm with their annual departmental report, I've then followed that up with an interview with the head of department in their own space. And so in September of 2011, then when they sent in their annual reports, I then went and talked to each of them in their own department, and we walked through, and we do that every year. We have done it every year, so it means that I see the department anyway. But I also believe in a lot of the time of actually going to see people in their own space. And so just sort of wondering if I need to catch somebody in Westerns, then I won't wait to break time. I'll sort of go in the gap in between lessons, have a look at their timetable and see what they're doing. I wander over to Westerns, and so you can actually catch them in the break, but also you probably talk to about half a dozen other people, not necessarily heads of department, and you begin to get a feel for what's going on, whether it's the fact the economists let all of their kids have inordinately long breaks, which disturbs the whole of Westerns, or whatever. I mean, there are things you pick up, and to actually being out of the office is the best way. I've found at the beginning, I still to this day think that that's the best way of sort of information gathering and understanding what's happening, for want of a better phrase, on the shop floor.
And those heads of department meetings, which when you first arrived were happening in the Busby Library, are now so large that they tend to be in the lecture room.
Yes.
So it's quite a lot of plates that are spinning.
I think the tone of those meetings has changed hugely. With Tristram, they were all still pretty lively because it was old school heads of department. With Stephen, I think because of the way in which he operated, it became much less of a discussion forum. And those who had been the firebrands in the past essentially quietened down, and they became much more benign affairs as actually chairing them. Sometimes I used to sort of despair the fact you'd have items on the agenda and nobody would be responding at all, yet people had put items on the agenda. So that's how it has gone. So the tone of them has changed, and I think in part that's because we have a senior management committee where a lot of those decisions are taken outside of the context of heads of department. So as sort of heads of department meetings or challenge committee meetings, things would be decided. Now it's all sort of SMC. And so I think, you know, people are thinking there's probably not a lot we're going to achieve in a heads of department meeting.
Do you think there's been a bit of a decline in the autonomy of the different departments too, in terms of even selecting exam boards, with maybe pressure to do at one point the pre-EU and then back to modular A-levels?
I don't think that's changed at all. I don't think there was any pressure put on anybody to do the pre-EU. Mm-hmm. I think the departments which chose to do it at the beginning were the ones which wanted to do it. Nobody was asked to do it. And I think at some time it came from members of staff who were actually working with the exam boards, like Geraint working with Cambridge Assessment and his involvement with the pre-EU. So I don't think we have done that. And I certainly work on the basis that heads of department can do effectively what they like. They do have that autonomy, and that I believe is an important part of what Westminster is about. The minute I start telling heads of department what to do, then I know we're going to lose a little bit of the magic. Because they're all really talented, lots of subject specialists, and as long as they're sort of delivering the exam results, I don't really mind how we get there, as long as what's going on is compliant. That's the key thing. As long as they're delivering on learning support and providing support for those pupils, that's a key part of it. As long as prep is being set regularly. And by and large, our departments do just that.
You mentioned when you first came in that you were part of the reason you were brought in was because the exam results for geography seemed to be revealing a problem. And do you think it's perhaps a little bit of a myth that goes around that we've become more focused on exam results?
I think it is a myth. I don't think we have become more focused on exam results because I think we've got greater breadth of activity on offer elsewhere. I think there's so much more going on in Westminster now than 1990. The pupil-led society, it is astonishing, that array that we have. The sport has mushroomed out of all recognition. And the fact we now have a sports centre, people doing station spend more time doing station. I remember in the 1990s people saying, well, no, if you do this station, you only get 25 minutes exercise on a Tuesday afternoon and another 25 minutes on a Thursday. Is this right? So I think we do other things, and lots more music has grown out of all recognition. One sort of, if one looks at the almanac from the 1990s and the almanac of today in terms of regular music activities or, you know, ensembles and bands playing, it's like sort of arrived in music school, music college. Drama, again, really, really lovely. So I think, yes, we are concerned about exam results. I don't think we're more focused on them. I don't think we're more of an exam factory. I think there's just we pack more into what goes on, and in a way it helps justify the fees, because we do actually produce an awful lot in the course of a day here.
One of the things you've hinted at there is the improvement of the school's facilities. I wondered if you could contrast the sort of classroom space that was available in 1990 with what we have now.
If I tell you that room 62, where I taught geography for a very long time, it was an old chemistry lab. Sutcliffe was the old science department. So I had the remains of a fume cupboard in my classroom. The heating system didn't work. And so my whole classroom in the winter was heated by a small fan heater. And I was told I was lucky to get that. So we have improved enormously. When one thinks that we didn't have Westerns then, that we were teaching on this corridor, this was a classroom. Graham Bartlett had his bed in here. There's a thought. We had very, very little space. We were squashed. We even claim today we're squashed, but the school's only grown by about 130, maybe not as many as that. Gone from somewhere over 600 to somewhere north of 750. So we are really well off for space now. What the classrooms, apart from the maths department, all look well looked after, and heads of department are actually concerned about the physical setting in which they are operating. Whereas in 1990 it was, you're lucky if you've got a room, be grateful, get on with it.
And I suppose we should move on to talk a little bit about China. How did you first come to be involved in the project? And when?
When, okay. Patrick had sort of been playing around with it in the latter part of 2016. Most mornings I see Patrick at sort of 7:30, 7:20 to 8, just to run through whatever's happening. And one morning in January of 2017, I went in there and having a chat, and then he finished by saying, take this away, read it tonight and let me know what you think. And he gave me a brown envelope, I think, what's inside it. So I took it home and read it, and it was all sort of the initial stuff, him reporting back on his visit to China over the Christmas break. And so next morning I said, well, I think it might have legs. I think, you know, it would be silly not to explore this further. And so that was how it started. And then I sort of didn't hear too much about it. And then Chris said to me, we've got the meeting tomorrow with the lawyers about the MOU. I'm expecting you there to meet the Chinese. And so that was the start of it. Then once the MOU was signed, then they said, well, can you carry on now the work you've just started, which consisted of a conversation with the Chinese, and having read this envelope, can you carry on doing it now, because, you know, we haven't got the capacity to do it, so we'd like you to get the agreement sorted out for us. And so that was suddenly thinking, okay, yes, now I'm into a world which is commercial and legal, and I'm dealing with the Chinese and having to learn a culture which I have never had any understanding of before, let alone business culture. And that was it. And so I hadn't been to China at that point. So June 2017, I went off to China for my visit, just to see what it was like. And from there on, I just became immersed in the project. And so first of all, it was getting the agreements negotiated, which was interesting, rewarding, challenge, two steps forward, about three back on most occasions. And then the whole thing, once the agreements were signed, then it was, can you actually start work on getting things in place for the school? And then suddenly I'm being thrown curriculum, architects, HR, budgeting, for somewhere which is halfway around the world. And the governor said to me, well, you know, you've set up one school, so it should be quite easy to set up another school. And said, there's a difference. Harris Westminster is 5 minutes from our front door. We're looking here at somewhere which is 5,000 miles away in a totally different culture. And by then I'd done Harris Westminster for long enough to know that even something which is 5 minutes from your door is not easy. You know, it's a totally different culture. And so somewhere in China is going to be a challenge, a Herculean task.
Were the governing body always enthusiastic about it, or were there battles to be had there?
There were battles to be had, there were the naysayers, but by and large I think the sort of view that prevailed was that China is a tricky place to operate, and as long as we come out of it ahead of the game and we haven't lost any money, if all goes hopelessly wrong, then it is a risk worth taking. That was, you know, how the governors worked themselves round it. And I remember the governing body meeting when the final decision was being taken, and I was left to present the case for going to China, which was a little bit daunting, because I hadn't expected that. I thought the Overseas Committee would be extolling the virtues of setting up six schools in 10 years in China, but no, it was left to me. And I had no idea how that was going, but there wasn't too much dissent. The questions that were asked, the caveats were reasonable, and I wasn't surprised by any of them. So that's how it all sort of got to the starting line.
Was it difficult, given the secrecy that was necessary for the whole project, especially considering all the responsibilities you still have back at the school?
Was it difficult? Not really, because nobody knew too much about what I was doing, because Patrick explained when I went off to China that I was going off on some international, just looking at schools internationally. And that kept people quiet for a bit, and then people started to put two and two together, because I managed to go to Prague in the same half of term as I went to China, and so that Prague completely threw people off the scent for about 6 months, because they thought I genuinely was looking at international schools. And then suddenly when they realised I was going to China for a second time, they began to think, actually, what's going on here? And they also twigged that I wasn't doing any teaching. And I was just sort of doing the deputy head bit job, deputy head part, as well as the China part.
And have you enjoyed this enormous voyage of discovery? I mean, you said you'd never been to China before, so it's been a steep learning curve.
Steep learning curve. Each time feels like my first time in China, even though I've now been there, 11 times? No, 10? No, 11 times now. Yes. And I think what I say to people at the moment is, what I have said throughout, it has made me realise that you do need to challenge yourself in your life and to do something different. It's been huge fun learning all about China, huge fun discovering Chinese culture, a huge challenge teasing out how to work with the Chinese and how to read them. I was sent out there with no preparation, and so I've had to work everything out from first principles and just sort of take one step at a time, because there have been occasions when I've sort of sat and thought, gosh, if I said the wrong thing today, I could blow this whole deal out of the water. Because you are literally on a knife edge. When we're negotiating with them, because the Chinese like everything done yesterday, and they don't wait until when the lawyers who were working with us on the agreements were vetting the different drafts of it. If we didn't get a response immediately from the lawyers, then I'd have the Chinese on my back saying, where are we, what's going on? The full knowledge that they'd already pulled the plug on two other ventures because the legal work had taken too long and they weren't prepared to wait. So, yeah, it has been professionally rewarding. It has been exciting, but not without moments of,
And was it a natural decision to go out there and become the headmaster of the
first of
these
schools? Decision? I had to think about it for a long time. I had to think about it long and hard. In a way, what sort of made it easier was having done Harris Westminster and sort of done all the work beforehand and then handing it over to somebody else. One sort of feels that one hasn't completed the job. Mm. And I'm also at the stage in my career where I can go to China, and if it does go wrong, if it doesn't happen, I can come home and put my slippers on, and I haven't got a career that's dependent upon it. So that's actually quite nice. So it was in some ways easy, and also knowing that sort of then they will be told I can come back. I'm not sort of being sent off to Mars on the International Space Station for ever and a day. And you know, what is more, I've enjoyed working in Chengdu. I mean, that's an important part of it. The people I have out there that are working on the project, the team in the office there, they are terrific. They are terrifically hard working. I'm not quite sure that I go along with the idea if you stay in the office till 2 in the morning. But hey ho. But they are phenomenally hard working. And that sort of makes every day there professionally rewarding as well.
Obviously, it's your first time being a headmaster. What do you think you'll take from the different examples that you've seen over the years, both at Marlborough and, of course, the four heads you've worked under at Westminster?
Empowering those who are beneath you. Because otherwise you make very little progress and people become frustrated. And if you have appointed senior managers, then let them get on and manage. But also make sure that you are a presence, and so that you actually do communicate with people, that you do talk and you know what's going on. That's what I will take out there with me, which in a way is sort of what I've done with managing heads of department here.
Exciting. I hope maybe you'll come back and talk to us when you've talked to us again when you've returned home. Though maybe you won't ever come back. maybe this is the beginning of a completely new life in China.
It won't be completely new life. I need my escape route.
Is there anything that you would have liked to have talked about today that I haven't given you the opportunity to talk about, anything that I've left out or neglected?
I think the only thing I would add is that when one lives in the middle of London, one realises how privileged one is to be in the heart of the city, to be able to do things which, when you live even in the suburbs, you've got to plan weeks in advance of going off to the theatre or cinema or go out for a meal, or even when the children were small, just sort of picking Tom up from the underschool and going off to watch cricket at Lord's or the Oval at sort of 6 o'clock in the evening, and little things like that, and being right in the heart of it all. And Westminster's are so fortunate, and I have to pinch myself each and every time I come back if I've been away for a day to go to a conference, and sort of you see the Abbey or you see Big Ben when you come and think, do I really live here? Do I really work here? And that is something which is really, really special. The fact you see the world go by, whether it's the events of this week or whoever's visiting, what's going on in Parliament, the fact that one sort of taught, was teaching when, what was it? It was the IRA mortar bomb on number 10. You could actually feel it in your classroom, or lying in bed and listening to, again, quite early on in our time when there was an IRA bomb in a litter bin on Victoria Street. You know, things like that. You suddenly are in contact with a world which you don't experience when you are just a mile or two away. And staff who live in, those who work here during the daytime, and the pupils. And there's particularly the girls in the house. I always used to say, you're never, ever going to have this opportunity again unless you find yourself a career which allows you to buy round here. You're never going to have this opportunity to live in the middle of London and play in the middle of London and enjoy what's on offer. So take advantage of it for 2 years. And I've done that for 29 years, and I'm hugely privileged.
It's a very geographical note to end on. Thank you very much.
Thank you.